It turns out that you can expand space faster than the speed of light. You just can't transfer information faster than light. So, anyway, I guess I should shut up and just move on with the class because we're sort of trying to talk about a lot of things that we'll be talking a lot about. So, let's sort of start at the start. I'd like to talk a little bit about the human experience. Because after all, that's sort of what we're used to. What would you say is the human experience in terms of time? How short a time is relevant to you?
How short a time is relevant?
In terms of your life, do you care about things that are separated by 10 seconds?
Yes.
A second? A millisecond?
It depends on whether you're an Olympics or not.
Exactly, yeah. You do care about milliseconds with modern timers and athletic events. Right? They actually, it matters in a millisecond. Microseconds? Do you care? I don't know. I mean, microseconds are particles. I studied particles in the group that's 10 to the minus 22 seconds. But, you know, generally, it's just a microsecond is just really irrelevant to your life. So, I would say that on the short end, sort of a millisecond is. And it's 0.01 seconds. So, what about on the high end? What's relevant to you?
Your lifespan.
Okay. So let's be optimistic and call it 85 years. Clearly that. Would you say longer?
I would say that longer. Children.
Also, I would say we have very real history, right? I mean, we commonly talk about things that are hundreds of years old, thousands of years old.
I would be in this hour, I think, mostly kind of an audio life can experience in some sense, like, at what point more do you close it down at the same time? Less because if you enter a more dilapidated state of your desire to have less time for this. You want that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And it is true that as you get older, your perception of time changes. Yeah. I'm beginning to sense that now. It is certainly true. When I was your age, it just seemed like life was really basically infinitely long. And now I actually stop and think, you know, because there's like a lot of these sort of things. Anyway, from terms of the human experience, so that's a very real personal experience, I would say. But sort of generally, things that are relevant, I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, the Romans and, you know, people in 1000 BC and whatever. We talk about geological time scales, but that's pretty hard to get your head around. When the Earth is, 4.3 billion years old. Okay, that doesn't mean a whole lot. So, I don't know. Let's say maybe thousands of years. So a year is something like 10 to the 7th seconds. Yeah, so we probably, it's not a mathematical course, but we're certainly going to be doing lots of things with scientific notation. So just to remind you, 1 is equal to 10 to the 1,
10 is equal to, sorry, 10 is 10 to the 1. 100 is equal to 10 squared. So every time I increment the exponent, I'm adding another 0. And then if I go 0.1 is equal to 10 to the minus 1, 0.01 is equal to 10 to the minus 2, 0.001 is 10 to the minus 3, etc. So we'll be doing lots of things with powers of 10. So I know you guys have seen that many times. Don't know that you're forced to use it all the time, so just a reminder. All right, so how about distance? What's the shortest distance that you give a crap about? Yes.
Yeah. You live in a very granular
world.
That's 100 microns. You're here. That's 100 times 10 to the 6.
Like, could we, in a general moment, like, all you care about is, like, the floor of the room, the temperature, but I don't know, like, in a certain situation, we would actually really care about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say millimeters are actually pretty macroscopic. I mean, you do know that a lot. I pull out the human hair. That's about as small a thing as you might normally run into. I mean, it's real. You see it all the time. That's 100 microns. So, I mean, if you're a biologist and you're doing cell biology, maybe you care about small things. Chemists do. I mean, certainly particle physics and those things. But I don't really see it. That's a little bit like this. It's almost like a video game type thing I play, right? I do these experiments and I make plots and stuff, but you know, how real is it? The hair is real. So I don't know. On the short end, you know, something like a tenth of a millimeter or something like that. So that's about 100 microns. And that's, so that's like a hair. Something on that order. How about big? What's the human experience with that?
Trust me.
Yeah. So, if you fly a lot, it's true, the size of the world starts to become more real to you in some ways. But if we use that scale, the circumference of the Earth is 25,000 miles. I got something like 18,000 frequent flyer miles. that's a reasonable order. If you start to move beyond that, I mean, the sun is 93 million miles away, but I don't really have a concept for that. It's even hard to imagine it in terms of how fast light travels. Light travels between here and the sun in 8 minutes. But light travels so fast, I don't have a concept of that. I calculated, I think light travels something like 60 times per second. It could, in principle, go 60 times between New York and San Francisco in a second. So that makes me feel more comfortable with that than I do thinking about the distance to the sun. But so let's say 10,000 miles, something like that. What about mass? It's the smallest mass.
Milligrams.
And you do run into that. I mean, I don't know. Most of us, unless you've done some chemistry, you don't really visualize milligrams enough, but we're certainly running into it a lot. I think we're seeing milligrams of sodium.
Sort of get some sense of that. So, yeah, a milligram. And then on the high end,
tons, yeah. A car, a truck, something like that. So,
a few tons. Okay, so that's... a lot of stuff. Let me see if I can do this. Ooh. Are you kidding me? They've disabled Java. Okay. Never mind. I'll have the link in the notes. You should look it up. There's sort of a cool link that it's probably not worth my trouble. I'd have to hook into the wireless here in order to get it to work on my laptop. And they've got the computer set up so that it's this Java system, I guess. But it's sort of a neat Java applet that starts out very big and goes down by factors of 10 to very, very small. And it's sort of a nice way of seeing how little of the reality that we actually already know about, we actually can perceive. So I have a few things that can give you some sense of that. So in terms of length, thickness of paper, this is about the low one that we're talking about. Up to about the radius of the Earth. So there's the human experience. And these other things are things that we actually have, we know about them. So the radius of our visible universe is 10 to the 26 meter. It's along with 26 zeros. It's huge. Down to the size of a proton, which is about 10 to the minus 15 meters. We actually know of things that exist where we have yet to measure how small they are. So quarks and electrons and things like some particles we'll talk a little bit about. We have probed to about 10 to the minus 18 meters, so 0.18 zeros and a 1. In terms of size, and still have not seen evidence for this structure. And we know it's there, but we haven't actually measured the size. Protons we have measured, and they're about 10 to the minus 15 meters. So it starts to be really hard to visualize the big numbers and the little numbers. But if we look at time, the universe has been around about the numbers now about 13.7 billion years or something. They translate it to seconds, it's roughly that. This is sort of the human scale, maybe three times 10 to the 9, down to milliseconds.
all of us. But we'd actually measure the lifetime of a particle for 10^-25 seconds. And we have inferred days of the universe up to about 10^17. So this is, again, huge scales
of which the human experience is only a little piece of it. For mass,
we don't actually know this number. We're still looking for it. We know they have mass. We have actually measured how small they are. This is, we have measured to about 10^-31 kilograms. This is sort of the realm of the human experience. But we've actually been measured, you know, we can measure the mass of galaxy. Yeah.
How would you do that? I don't really think. I don't think you answer that. I don't see that.
Well, you know, it's sort of funny. When I was in graduate school, I had to figure out what I wanted to do. And I decided not to be an astrophysicist or an astronomer because you can't do a controlled experiment. You can't turn the accelerator on and off, so that's probably the part of physicists that could do that. But what they do is they look out in the sky and all of the experiments have already been done. And they just measure and categorize and understand it. So it's actually a really cool methodology. So they study stars. They study other luminous objects. They can look at the nearby ones and they can figure out how the luminosity, the brightness of these things correlates to the mass of the objects, where they can actually measure the mass in different ways. So we know the mass of the sun in many ways, including understanding how gravity works and how the orbits work and everything like that. So if you understand gravity and you look at how things move, you can actually infer a lot about what their masses are. For things that are much further away, having looked at those nearby objects, you can correlate what the masses are with the brightness. And then all you have to do is look at the brightness. And from that, you can begin to infer mass. So the other thing is, you can look at how all the stars in a galaxy rotate. And that rotation also gives you some indication of the mass. It turns out that one of the great mysteries recently uncovered in the last, I guess it was first inferred in the 1930s, it was then sort of confirmed in the 50s, and it's now become like one of the hottest topics in physics, which is if you go and you look at how the stars and galaxies move around, it turns out that we can't actually see about 80% of the mass at all, but we know it's there from the effect on gravity. On the motion of stars. We call that dark matter, and we'll talk a bit about dark matter. So the astronomers really can infer a whole lot. So it's amazing what they can actually get out of looking at stars and light curves and things like that. So our experience is a small fraction of what we see out there. And one of the places where that comes in is that what makes sense to us, what is the bias that we use in interpreting what we see and in building models for what we see, is a reality, it's something that has evolved in a reality where these narrow ranges of experience are relevant. And so one of the messages that I hope you get as you end this class is when you move outside of those ranges, you start to see phenomena that you can't fit into the intuition that you're used to seeing. Actually, I'm going to pass this around. Be sort of careful with it. A little heavy. Just pass it around. It's an object that sort of defies your expectations a little bit. So it turns out that if you study things that go really fast, that our concept of space and time seem to not work. If you look at things that are really small, our ideas of how things move and interact are completely different. So there's this whole idea of human bias that's just, it's very important to sort of keep in mind that your intuition is a very good guide. It's really all we have for building models and trying to understand the universe. But now that we have the capability of looking at realms of reality that are far outside of what we normally experience, it's not obvious to me that you have to feel warm and fuzzy about it. And one of the things, there'll be some discussion about it, I think, in some of the mathematical, the papers on that that we'll see this week. There are a number of reasons that we use math in science, but one of the reasons is because you can actually develop tools in mathematics that allow you to see things that your intuition doesn't really get. And so
it can be very powerful that way. So what do you think of this brick?
But why does it surprise you? You've seen a lot of things that size. You pick up a lot of things that size. Not often can we see that something that heavy. Okay? It's not gold, unfortunately, it's lead. But it's always a shock when you pick it up. So this is very much, I guess, one of the other messages I think I mentioned last time, you don't have to go outside the realm of what is really common. I mean, that is a common size, and it's even a common mass. It's just strange because it's so different from what you're used to seeing. So when you look at everyday life, everyday phenomena, very careful and very precise, you can find that your intuition can often mislead.
And that's a little bit what physics, certainly sort of how physics started out, is to try to understand everyday life. You know, if you throw a ball, where is it going to land? Why are the planets orbiting the way they are? Things like that. So, okay. So you guys have been thinking some this week about art and science and religion.
One can argue that all three are a way of gaining insights into the nature. How do they differ?
Scale. Well, science looks at different scales.
Yeah.
And in a way, sort of, you know, like philosophies of life and politics and religion are a bigger scale and different than a human scale, as opposed to like distances in space and time. Like micro is, I'll just look at this scale, try to understand it. And religion looks at life and try to understand it. Outside of the scale of an individual's life.
Okay, maybe.
Okay. Yes.
Because I might not call scale, I might think of them, they are different regimes.
I actually have a question. Can you explain kind of like what you're getting at, maybe what methodologies you have in mind by including art in the question? To me, science and religion, that's a common debate, but throw art in there, kind of job.
Okay. Well, I think art has different realms. One of which is, you know, entertainment, just flat out beauty. But I think artists often have great insight into something. And it is through that art that they're able to express that. So if you heard mourning and hear Dennis,
have you ever heard it? Do you know the one I'm talking about? Let me see if I can do anything with this stupid computer. See if I can even. And pay no attention to the video, just close your eyes. I don't know what you see, but I didn't have to know what this was called when I heard it. I mean, I just saw the sunrise. And it's a beautiful, it's music, but it also really paints the sunrise in a way. Maybe you see something different, but I think lots of art is done in a way that it shows great insight into some aspect of nature. So that's a little bit. But it has its own methodology, which is very personal, both in its creation and in its inception. You may have totally gotten something completely different out of that music. So there's a lot of ambiguity in it. Yeah.
I would add, like, on the academic side, people who study art, like, frequently look for answers to, like creative art. I mean, people like read literature and write criticism, like looking at how to live, how to conduct human relations, how to deal with nature. I mean, it goes on and on. It's not just about like expressing your life skills through art, it's also like examining art and looking for human experience.
Yeah. I think along with that, especially with music, there's the academic study of music is very focused on the structure. And for patterns, this kind of thing, which I think is kind of similar to science and
belief. Well, yeah, the mathematical structure of music and mathematical structure of mathematics and stuff, they're very similar. I mean, I'm a musical idiot. That was the extent of my musical skill set. But I have a lot of friends who do sort of what I do, and you know, there's this one guy who works with our group, he's a friend of mine. He makes Sheldon look cool. And this guy is about as strange a guy as you would ever know. He's a very talented physicist, but he's personally one of the most awkward people. One of the things that I do for my research group is I interpret him to the Department of Energy and other people, because he does really great stuff, but he can't interface with reality. So I'm chatting with him at some meeting, and it turns out he's a fabulous classical guitar. I mean, real good. And it's just sort of weird.
So there's a lot of overlap between science and math, but Okay, so the thing about art, though, is
there's a lot of ambiguity. I think it can be really insightful, but there's a lot of ambiguity. So you may have great insight, you may produce something that has great insight, but I may receive it and interpret it in a completely different way. And everybody's right. So it's a beautiful feeling. So what about religion?
I think that unless you sort of have your own personal thought on religion, like you can have your own internally, but externally it's very sensed on a lot of things where, at least with Christianity, you're being sort of told what's happening, whereas with science or art, you're allowed to develop your own insights that you can put out words. There's no such thing as being told what's happening.
So, this is really interesting to me as a religion student, right? And I took a class with Frank, right, who's really interested in these questions. And I think that there's often a really big problem in the way that we talk about science and religion, particularly in the way that we talk about them, is often as a dichotomy, right, where, like, we have to sort of solve the problem, like the conflict between science and religion. And I think a lot of that sometimes stems from the fact that particularly in American universities, we're dealing with a very specific kind of conflict between science and religion, right? Like this conflict between Judeo-Christianity, and particularly this like very American brand of Christianity that's often sort of very oppositional towards science. And I just think it's, you know, often this discussion is really important to sort of think about just as there's like a really broad diversity of opinion in science, there's also a really broad diversity of opinion and experience in religion. And, you know, if you talk to someone who's immersed in Hinduism, you know, the idea that, like, rather than having this, like, strict explanatory, you know, purpose for religion where they're going to tell you that the earth was created in 6 days, you know, the scientific idea that you're sort of figuring out how to navigate this universe with some preset rules, and that your role is maybe to sort of figure out what they are and how to sort of navigate them, is like much more of a, you know, sort of intuitive idea for them. So I think that often those conversations really get stuck in this like evangelical Christians
think that evolution is bullshit. Yeah, that's probably true. Okay. But in terms of a methodology for understanding the world around us, what would you say is, how does religion operate? But, and now, it is true. That's too simple and naive a question, probably, because what religion are you talking about?
Well, I'm not saying that those aren't the terms that, at some point, we just sort of have to accept and deal with.
Yeah. So, you have a thought?
Also related to you.
Yeah.
I think religion has a lot of bad rap because people often debate religion as an institution with their religious beliefs daily. And a lot of times different branches of religions, different sects of one particular religion have different claims. And people sometimes just kind of pick the stupidest and put up there in comparison with, say, the Bateman theory or other incomplete verifiable claims that science makes and say, well, religion is stupid. I think both religion and science try to create this dichotomy of the world, try to establish this all-encompassing theory about how the world works and how we as individuals should participate in this whole action. So it's just really the material that I work with, not necessarily the actual products that we use, if that makes sense. Because from a scientific view, a lot of religious claims seem backward and not had by the actual physical realm. But if you enter this so-called mythical mode of thinking, which is already interactive in its own reason, but if you enter this mode of thinking, you can sort of see the cosmic causality between a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily different from, say, if I assert force on the Snapchat view.
Okay. Well, I'm not here to bash religion. I'm really just wanting to talk about this methodology.
Yeah, I feel like religion operates more within the human experience and is trying to like make sense of things in sort of magnitudes that we understand, and like leaving that outside of our experience, like those truths outside of our experience, like sort of up to the higher power, sort of in the methodology. Which, so like, I think what like I was trying to like talk about is more of like how it's passed on by like tradition and like, you know, like you go to Sunday school and then you like that's sort of like where you like first get your religious experience, where you go to like the I don't know what you call it, like wherever you go to like sort of get your like here, like more of like a philosophy type view on it. Like because there are like a lot of philosophical things, especially if you're like looking more like Eastern view of the world.
It's a very personal thing.
Yeah.
I mean it's a personal story. It's a personal faith. I mean I think part of the issue is when you want to make it more than that, that's where religion hits some of its bad rap. Did you have a comment?
I was going to say, for that reason, I think art is
something ridiculous. Sorry?
Yeah. I was going to say, for that reason, like art is something ridiculous.
Art is?
I mean, you said art is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Religion
is also, because it's very personal.
Right.
It's personal, yeah. Okay. So, I actually personally don't see a conflict between science and religion because they're just completely different things. I think you get a conflict when you try to take one and sort of shove it on the other's face somehow. Religion is a personal thing and it's a matter of faith. It's what you feel personally comfortable with. I'm no expert on things and we've probably gone on for quite a while, but I sort of see it that way. I mean, it's got its personal standards. What feels right to you, what sounds right to you, where you grew up, where your comfort zone. And that's sort of where it belongs. It is something that a person can use to create a worldview that they're comfortable with. And science, of course, can be a religion. Okay, so that's we can go there if you want. And I think when science becomes a religion, that's also sometimes where you get this conflict. Okay. But let's talk for a minute about science itself. Science is different. What do you think? What makes science different? Yeah.
It's just what it is. It's cold.
It's cold.
It can be cold. It can be beautiful, but it's just what it is. It's not if you feel good about species dying off and evolution, it's not if you feel good about better snakes that exist. It's just,
I don't know. Science can make you feel very good about how the intricate beauty of the universe all there's a huge amount of complexity it takes to make things work, and it's really an amazing thing. So it's not clear to me that science is cold, but why would you say it's cold? There are very particular characteristics of science that are absolutely essential to what makes science what it is, which makes it seem cold and makes its papers absolutely horrid to read.
So I would say that's like kind of the like ostensible side of science, and it kind of works itself to be like just where things are, like very objective, etc. In the same way that religion kind of purports itself to be a very personal, feel good thing, but can become an institution for like taking the heads of organization, etc. But so I'm a writing tutor last night, actually, in this paper where the student was writing about how in a lot of books and like textbook type science books on like reproduction, the female reproductive system is always characterized as like very passive, very receptive, the male is very like active and heroic in some ways. And then at the very best, the female reproductive system is kind of like dangerous and threatening. It's like, you know, killing the other sperm. So like, it, you know, at worst very passive, at best like very scary. And that has a lot to do with like the subjectivity of science, right? Like we see what we want to see, or we see what's there, but we say it how we want it to be. And so there is a lot of that in science, but we don't necessarily think about it all the time in the same ways that we don't think about kind of the darker sides of academia in terms of the arts, or you know, the kind of the fraternity system of religion or the arts.
Okay, so science is done by people. And that certainly comes through, and we'll see many, many instances of that, but I think some of that. There's a lot of art in science, and I'll maybe we'll try to help us. One of the messages of this class is this. But let's come back to, on a slightly higher level, what science is supposed to do. Okay.
Yeah, I'm back to what you were saying about how science can be cold. I think it doesn't have to be. But inherently, I think, I mean, religion and science wanted to agree that Earth was at the center of the solar system, but then religion was not ready to allow scientists to prove that that was not the case, that the sun was at the center of the solar system. But, like, I think in that way, religion wants to sort of... wants their faith and wants what they believe to be true, whereas science is always looking to not just come up with new ideas, but disprove ideas and sort of, you know, they're never looking to, I mean, the way we want it to be, not without bias, without human bias. Scientists are looking to further understanding, whether that be understanding to something that we're not, we don't want to be true, but it is true, you know. So I think it can be cold because inherently it's not looking for what we want or what we don't want. It's looking for what is accurate.
It's looking for what it is. What it turns out,
yeah. It wants to know what you're doing. Scientists want an answer, whereas religion wants
an answer. I mean, I don't think that that was... I think that you're right about science like looking for accuracy and something. But, I mean... the sort of point of the article on Copernicus, right, was that it wasn't, it actually, you know the story about Galileo, right, where like, you know, the church was like, we don't want to believe this, so you have to be quiet now. And I think the point of the article was basically like, no, Copernicus wasn't silenced by the church. Copernicus was silenced by other scientists.
No, that's why I love that article. Because it is so... It tells a history that is different from what we grow up sort of believing. And we talk about the Copernican revolution, and it was not quite so simple.
Yeah, and just that, you know, and it wasn't that other scientists didn't want to believe it because they just didn't like it. It was because the observations were not good enough that his math made sense.
Well, there were lots of reasons. I mean, scientists, even now, lots of scientists like to believe in Platonic ideals and beautiful mathematics, and very much. I mean, relativity, general relativity, was accepted almost overnight, in part because mathematics is beautiful. I mean, it's not, there are, the next step beyond the bridge might be the discovery of supersymmetry, but if you nail a theorist down and you say, why do you really believe in this? I mean, my quantum field theory professor in graduate school was writing stuff up on the board teaching us about supersymmetry, and he turns around and he goes, this has to be true. It's just so beautiful. And we were just sort of like, oh, you're shitting me. Really? And he was just overwhelmed with the beauty of the symmetry that led to this theory. And the thing that's cool, which is part of what we were discussing this week in the math papers, is very often it turns out to be the case that nature does seem to work by the rules of beautiful mathematics, but there are many economies. So let me talk for a moment about this coldness of science. Science in the ideal world where you know you're not hampered by the fact that you're human, really is the idea of creating sort of a model, an idea, and then looking out at the universe around you, whatever it is you're talking about, and making observations, and then trying to fit it within that model, that hypothesis. And sometimes it doesn't fit to such a degree that you have to throw this whole thing out and revise it, or revise it. And usually it's sort of in revisions. But sometimes it turns out to be an absolute revolution, where what you thought was true is just flat out wrong, and it's turned on its head. The thing, there are a couple of things that, I mean, this is really the power of scientific methodology in my mind, is the fact that observation is key. So we had some discussion about, is there scientific truth or whatever? And my guess is many scientists probably believe in some Platonic ideal of a real model of the universe that we sort of are looking at. I mean, it's hard to justify doing science if you don't sort of believe in such a thing. Because what are you trying to figure out if there's not some truth out there that you're sort of trying to get to? But at the same time, everything we do in terms of science is only a current understanding. And one observation that runs counter to your expectation of that model, one observation that you can all agree on is there's a valid thing, can completely throw it out the window and ask repeatedly. And that, to me, is one of the major powerful things about the methodology of science, is you're able, you have sort of observation as key, not necessarily your intuition. Your intuition may cause a lot of argument along the way. You do have to interpret things. You do have to fit it in what you were thinking, the framework of truth, that you can completely throw it out the window. So the other thing about science is if it hinges on observations, what does that mean?
Well, you hope.
Yeah, you hope. And in fact, one of the dissatisfying things with the whole multiverse idea is that maybe that we actually are doing philosophy, because we almost by definition can never step out and prove that we're the multiverse. But let me go back a little bit. The observation is a critical piece. The experimental observation is the thing that makes science work. But if we're going to do that, what does it really mean to observe something? I can go see something. I mean, I observe, if you will, this piece of music. And you did too. But we may well have had very different ideas of what that was. Okay, so for science to work, first of all, it's pretty constrained. You're not going to really, maybe doing this based on a neuroscience lab or something, but you won't get scientists arguing about something a bit fuzzy like the interpretation of a piece of music. So science is a bit limited in its realm of what you can and cannot do, just because, in a sense, you have to observe it. Then, if you observe it, it has to be repeatable, because you do have faulty observations. So we have to all be able to agree on what's been observed. So for that to happen, I have to tell you what I observed. And I have to tell you that in such enormously hard detail that you can, on the other side of the world, duplicate it or know that you've seen the same thing. And I think that's really the origin of science's coldness. Because I can't tell you the ball is round. I have to tell you how many centimeters it is. I have to tell you the degree of roundness. What's the error in the ball? I have to tell you when the ball is. Not just where it is. to tell you where we have to agree on system and measure. To tell you how big it is, we have to agree. We're talking furlongs, we're talking inches, we're talking millimeters. Once I know it's this big, how well do I know that? Is it this big plus or minus a millimeter? Is it this big plus or minus a foot? Those are very different observations. The observation is completely incomplete if I don't tell you how good it is. So all of a sudden, no matter what it is, if I measure it in that kind of detail and I then try to describe it to you, you have what turns out to be scientific literature. And it's horrible. And it makes science seem very cold because it's out of necessity, all about the details of the observation. And there is beauty and there is art in that, but it is carefully disguised in all numbers and errors and all the other stuff that's not necessary. Yes?
That's why it's not the opposite. It's
Well, you can argue about it. There's a beauty to nice measurements. There's a beauty. There is actually, believe it or not, there really is bad scientific writing and good scientific writing. I mean, it can be done well, but it's not a novel. There's a lot of beauty in science, and there's a lot of warmth in it, but because it's about the observation and conveying all that observation, I think it comes off as dispassionate in many ways. And so, but I think the thing that really sets the methodology apart is that, I mean, the two things. One is the reliance on observation, and the other is the struggle to make your description of things to be as unambiguous as possible, which is where all the numbers come in. And it's also one of the reasons that we use mathematics, because if we want to talk about, if we want to describe a ball in English, it necessarily has a lot of meaning. If you want to describe the mathematics, and I go to the trouble of defining the system, what I mean by the errors, and et cetera, and make that very clear, then I can describe things in a very unambiguous way. So that's part of why science is stuck with the language. And it's truly awful in a sense. I mean, music, and I think art in general has it over science in some ways, because I can appreciate the beauty of that music, and I can't read music well. And I understand there is a deep level of appreciation and skill in music that I'm nowhere near. Okay, that I do understand. But I can at least appreciate it in a certain level. What I hope is with this class, I can get you to appreciate some aspects of science that we're doing these days conceptually. But the truth is, a lot of it, I mean, in my formal training as a physicist, I was probably a junior to a senior in college before I saw the first really cool, beautiful physics things insightfully looking at, reading the music, if you will, seeing Maxwell's equations and how it pops a lot of things up. Finally, I sort of understood something that I could never put into words before that. And that's pretty late in the game to sort of really grow to appreciate something. So science is really, we suffer in our ability to try to convey the insightful beauty of a lot of what's being done, because the language that we use requires so much training. that it's pretty horrible. And I think that's true at some level, no matter what you do overall. If you go deeply into things, you become very, there are multiple layers of lingo and things, and I think you gain a lot of appreciation for it that at lower levels you don't. But somehow, I always feel a little cheated. I feel like I can turn on music and appreciate it, and it's not so easy to do if you're at the final campus. Okay. Anybody have any burning thoughts they want to get off their chest? All right, well, that was fun. It's a good place to stop on Wednesday.